How did you spend last night? You know, we've been talking to voters for the past 2.5 months, and here's how they spent election night 2020.
It's Denise Carr from Buffalo, New York. It's about 12:30 a.m. Eastern time on election night. I'm about to head to bed, and I'm finding myself a bit surprised at how close the election results are rolling in thus far.
Mike Richards from Orlando, Florida. It's 11:30 p.m. Eastern time. I'm concerned. I personally do not want to see uniform Democratic control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency.
Hi, this is Ahmed Zubaydi. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon. This is like first time I celebrate to vote after I got my citizenship. And honestly, I feel scared and I have a huge concern.
This is Randy Schmidt, Lone Rock, Wisconsin. It's 1 o'clock Central Time. The race looks like it's still too close to call. I guess the part that I'm feeling good about is that the American people are participating in the greatest democracy ever created this year. And let's hope whoever does end up winning that we can come together as a country and get behind, because America will definitely have spoken.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. And yes, we have been saying for months now, do not expect a result on election night. So here we are. And we're going to acknowledge the uncertainty of this moment. We're going to check in with key swing states over the course of this hour. But we will also think through what has been revealed by the vote count thus far. Because understanding this country, I believe, is as important, if not more, than knowing who's going to lead it. So let us start today with Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Did you get any sleep last night, Jack?
I did. Thank you.
Good. So you're obviously, we are still in the midst of a race that has not finished yet. Vote counts are going on. But based on what we could glean from last night, what are some of your takeaways?
Well, one is that presidential elections are no longer conditions-based. They are identity-based. What do I mean? Well, consider the conditions. A pandemic, the economy. You know, you can look at whole industries that have been sidelined by economic and pandemic triggered changes, and the character of the president. You know, even his own supporters have called him recently unfit. Another said he was a threat to the existence of the republic. Yet none of that mattered to about half the country, because increasingly politics is about social identity. I am a Democrat. I am a Republican in the way I am a left-hander or a right-hander. What's the implication of that?
And so,
the politics is no longer conditions-based. Well, I'll just finish the thought.
Yeah, please go ahead,
Jack. It means that the mainspring of change in America, in American politics, the dynamics of change are frozen. There's a theory called critical elections theory. This is identified with great scholars of the post-war era, V.O. Key, Walter Dean Burnham. And basically, they posit critical elections, 1828, 1860, 1896, 1932, in which there is a realignment of the electorate. Because of social conditions that are unmet, there are sharp and durable voter alignment changes. That is, people who had been Republican because of conditions vote Democrat, and that remains a durable kind of coalition, as the New Deal coalition was. Dean Burnham has called realigning elections, critical elections, America's answer to social revolution. It is the mainspring of change in American politics. If it is frozen, if because politics is based on identity and not conditions-based, and realignment can't happen, that means change can't happen. Politics is paralyzed.
I see. So you're seeing the 2020 election in that frame. But just to underscore, so if I understand what you're saying correctly, Jack, you see it as a frozen electorate? Is that what you said? That's incapable of realignment around issues?
I do believe that's the case. If politics is identity-based, it floats free and above conditions. I mean, you could even see in even fear of death. I mean, people were turning out to Trump's rallies, even though we saw that Stanford study, 30,000 people had become infected. Maybe hundreds had died because of these. It didn't matter. This is about identity. Now, how this has come about is a long question. Its consequence is, though, that the dynamics of change in the system, which were these critical elections with realignment, that is frozen.
Okay. So, Jack, you've given us a lot to think about, and I'm going to keep that sort of on the front burner here as we dig into what's happening in some critical states right now. First, in Michigan, where Wayne County Clerk Kathy Garrett told CNN this morning that counting ballots fast is not the goal.
We're not in a competition. It's just very important that we are accurate, and we will be here until the job is done.
Well, joining us now from Detroit is Stephen Henderson, host of WDET's Detroit Today and executive editor of Bridge Detroit. Stephen, hello.
Hey, Magna. How are you?
How are you? Wayne County is one of the epicenters right now of America's political future. So what's going on there?
Yeah. Well, we are counting the ballots, as Kathy said. We are counting. We are counting and counting and counting. And we won't be done until all the ballots are counted. We do know a little more now than we did when she said that. It was about 7 a.m. when she went on CNN to talk about that, and they had just begun really counting some of the mail-in ballots that we have. We have more mail-in ballots here in Wayne County and Detroit than anyone could imagine, really. But since that time, Joe Biden, the Democratic challenger to the presidency, has taken the lead in the count. And I think it's really important to say it that way, that in the counting, he is ahead. And Gary Peters, the U.S. senator who's up for re-election, the Democratic senator up for re-election, has really narrowed the gap between himself and his challenger, Republican John James. And so I think this is a narrative that's starting to play out in a number of these key states that hang in the balance: Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. You've got big urban centers in all of those states who had an incredible number of voters who voted before Election Day. And I love the way that the president comes out and says, we have to stop them from voting. We have to stop them from counting because Election Day is over. These are people who voted first. These are people who voted in some cases weeks ago and sent their ballots off. How outrageous would it be to determine that they don't get to count? But in all of these states, that practice was much more heavily used by people in big urban areas. And think about one of the reasons why the pandemic is still going on and is still really, really crushing us in these places. People were very apprehensive about going to the polls. So they got ballots, they filled them out, they dropped them in the mail, they dropped them with the clerk. And so now we're counting those. And the turnout in these areas is just historic. Here in the city of Detroit, we are expecting to surpass the turnout that we saw in 2008, which was the first year that Barack Obama was on the presidential ballot, and we set a record that year. We will have more votes in Detroit this year than that year. And what that means is that the support for Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee, is not going to show up until you get into those early ballots, which now have to be counted late because of the restrictions that we have under state law. And so it is going to become, I think, throughout the day, more and more evident the kind of support that Joe Biden was able to get in areas like this, and we'll know more about whether that carries him to victory nationally.
So, Stephen, let me just highlight something you just said, that one of the reasons why there is a prolonged count that has to go on is because of, as you said, restrictions under state law that prevented these ballots from being counted as they came in earlier, before Election Day.
Yes. So in 2018, here in Michigan, we changed our constitution to expand the ability for people to vote early, for people to vote absentee for whatever reason they wanted to, and to make themselves, you know, to avail themselves of all the different ways that you can cast ballots. But what that constitutional amendment didn't do, it, you know, they always have to be animated by legislation, and the legislation that accompanied that amendment talked about when votes could be counted, mm-hmm. and restricted them to Election Day and beyond. It's not necessarily the most cynical thing in the world. I mean, I think there is a danger in too early counting, mm-hmm. and that could influence the outcome, influence people who still plan to go vote on Election Day. But saying that you can't even start before election morning really ties the hands of clerks in this pressure that gets put on them on Election Day to say what the result is. I mean, the expectation, I think, for most voters is, well, I voted and I want to know by midnight when I go to bed what the outcome is. Well, that's not really possible if you have millions of votes, as we right. as we did here in Michigan, that were cast that way.
And so right now it's in terms of the highest number of remaining ballots to be counted, is that in Wayne County?
Yes. Okay. We still have, and I have to say, before I went on the air today here at 9 a.m., we still had hundreds of thousands of ballots, I believe, out in Wayne County. There are also some ballots in Grand Rapids, which is a city on the western side of the state whose city proper is very heavily Democratic as well. They're still counting there.
All right. So Stephen Henderson, our eyes and ears in Michigan for us today. Hang on. Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst with us from New Hampshire. Stand by. When we come back, we're going to drop down into Florida and Texas and lessons learned there. Really interesting state and states and counts last night. So we're talking about where we are with all this uncertainty the day after Election Day and the nation that is speaking. Who are we now? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is the day after Election Day, and so we are touching down in key states across the country. Stephen Henderson is with us. He's host of WDET's Detroit Today. He's with us from Detroit, Michigan. A lot of eyes on Michigan right now. Jack Beatty is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst. We're going to hear in a minute from Florida and Texas as well. But Jack, I just wanted to turn back to you quickly, because as you heard Stephen say before the break, that right now the largest number of ballots remaining to be counted in Michigan is in at least one of its major urban centers. And that could really influence the outcome of the vote in Michigan once all those ballots are tallied. And I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the other sort of vectors that have been revealed or maybe highlighted once again in the American electorate, urban-rural, for example.
Well, yes, I think that seems to be the main axis of division now. They're not class divisions. It's a division between the country and the metropole, the country and the city and the suburbs. And this was really the way American politics had been in the 1920s, before the realigning election of 1932. It was effectively a country resentment of the city based on city prosperity, country stagnation. Something like that is true in our country. The data is clear. Democratic congressional districts have higher incomes, more economic activity. Cities dominate the economy in terms of GDP. The country the hinterland lags. And it is, in effect, in this election, putting a grip on the metropole and saying, if we're not doing so well, neither will you. We're going to stop the gears of change. And I think there's that kind of resentment behind this. And to put it more positively, there's just the feeling of being neglected. Trump has said to these people, you are the forgotten voters. And in truth, they are.
Mm. Well, I think it also matters on the particularities of the state that those metropoles are in. So that is the perfect way to visit Florida and Texas. So first of all, we want to just listen to one of the voters that we talked to in our Voter Roundtable series. This is Robin Richard. She let us know what she was doing verging on 3 a.m. this morning in Pensacola, Florida.
It is 2:43 a.m. and I am shocked that it's so close. I'm just hopeful and prayerful that even if it takes a few days for all the states to get all the votes counted, that they will take that time to count all the votes. This is history. This is something to see.
Well, joining us now from Miami is Luis Hernandez. He's host of Sundial on WLRN, and he's also the afternoon anchor there. Luis, it's great to have you back.
Thank you, Magna.
And also with us from Houston, Texas, is Luis Carrasco. He's editorial writer and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board. Luis, it's great to have you back as well.
Great to be back, Magna. Thank you.
Okay, so Florida and Texas are really telling us a lot about America, I would say, today. So Luis, let's start with you. Your big takeaway out of what happened in Florida last night.
Well, first of all, as a longtime Floridian, for me to be able to speak to the nation, I'd love to say, hey, don't point the finger at us. We got it right. We're okay today. And that's important because, I mean, look, we're the butt of a lot of jokes, and I get it. We're always sitting on the edge of our seats before an election because we don't know what's going to happen. We know that races are really close here. They always are, but there's always that other X factor. We don't know what's going to happen. But really, what we saw yesterday is that everything we put in place over the last year and a half or so worked. We replaced old machines. We fixed the system as best we could. Things ran rather smoothly. And so we got the results. I think, if anything, people are surprised because, you know, the polls were telling us that Biden had a slight lead and Trump took the state pretty handedly.
Mm, okay. So that leads us to this big question. Not a big question, but I think a very important observation, which is, God, we shouldn't have to relearn this lesson over and over again. But don't take anyone for granted. Don't presume communities are monolith. Right. I mean, that's
exactly
that is what's happening in Florida and Texas. Luis, I'll turn to you on that. Isn't that what's happening? Isn't that what voters said last night there?
They definitely did. I mean, there was some softness with some Latinos here in Texas. Biden underperformed in the Rio Grande Valley. The president even made some limited gains in El Paso. These are, you know, very heavily Hispanic areas. And you have to look at, you know, the two Texas presidential hopefuls were very clear, Beto O'Rourke and Julian Castro. They said this over and over, which is that the National Party was taking Latinos for granted. And you saw that last night.
Okay, so I want to play a little bit of sound from a voter in Miami that we spoke to. This is Federico Arango, and he voted for the president.
Many, many Latinos and Hispanics did not vote for him in 2016. Many people were scared. I was not scared. You know, we weren't, but a lot of people were, especially older Latinos and Hispanics. They were terrified, you know, because of what CNN and then the news had told them about Trump. And so now it's very, very common to talk to people and say, hey, yeah. And, you know, in 2016, I didn't vote for the president, but afterwards I've seen what he's done and I've gone over to his side and I'm going to vote for him.
So Luis, you're there in Miami. First of all, just sort of help us sort through what the outcome in Miami-Dade tells us.
What it tells us is that, yeah, Biden and the Democrats took that vote for granted. Now, he did win Miami-Dade, as Hillary Clinton did. Mm-hmm. But the difference is The gap between Trump and Biden on the Latino vote shrunk by a lot. I mean, Hillary Clinton had double-digit lead in the Latino vote in 2016. And, you know, I'm looking at different numbers, but, I mean, it's almost down to 10% or less, that gap. Trump and the Republicans came in and they had a simple message, which was, you know, they knew how to approach the Latino vote, specifically the Cuban vote, the Cuban American vote, the Venezuelan vote, the you know, two very big groups here in Miami and South Florida, which is Democrats or socialists. You come from a socialist country. You don't want our country to become what your country became. That was their message, and it stuck. And especially with men, especially with Cuban men, Venezuelan men, Trump was successful in winning them over. Biden spent a lot of time here. President Obama came here in the final days, but they just never got past that messaging. The Republicans were able to get that to stick.
Well, and it also had an effect on down ballot races, right? I mean, there was a really important House race there, Republican Maria, a couple of races, right? So this, we want to hear a little bit from Republican Maria Elvira Salazar, who won over Democrat Donna Shalala in Miami, and here's Salazar last night.
As your Congresswoman, I vow that in Washington, I will represent the spirit that lives in this district, the ultimate melting pot, the city of Miami. To my constituents who did not vote for me, I will serve you as if you did. Amen. Because I will work for what is right, not who was on my side this election cycle.
Lewis, talk about that House race a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this race, and also it was Debbie McCarthy Powell losing to Carlos Jimenez, you know, the former Miami-Dade mayor, two House seats that switched over. Democrats thought they could keep. Look, with this race, I think what it came down to was this. This is how the pandemic impacted Florida. Florida depends so much on visitors, and we had to shut the state down. And I think that, there was just this feeling of government overreach. Mm. And, you know, the governor had Governor DeSantis, who's a big Trump supporter, was trying really hard to reopen the state quickly because he understood that. And you have a lot of folks down here, business owners, independents, who just they want to get to work. And they were willing to take the chance, put their lives on the line, because for them, putting food on the table was more important. So they saw it as government overreach. And I think that that was also one of the things that stuck on the Democrats was that, you know, they want to shut us down. They want to keep, you know, they want to put these restrictions on us. And I think that that really did help, not just with the president, but I think it helped in flipping two House seats.
Right. So, Luis, in Houston, let me turn back to you here, because I'm really interested in hearing from both of you about, you know, shattering this commonly held perception that the Latino community is any kind of monolith. Because even just in the Florida context, Lewis was talking about Cuban Americans, Venezuelan Americans. You had mentioned Americans in the Rio Grande Valley area. Can you talk to me a little bit more about those communities and sort of what they were communicating last night and how they voted?
It's strange. I mean, you talk about, you know, the Latino community is not only not a monolith, but within groups that you would think line up, because you look at Arizona, you look at Nevada, which seem to be trending towards the Biden camp, and you know that's Mexican Americans, and you look at Texas, and it is also Mexican Americans, but the difference has been stark. There's also, you know, we're going to have to look at this after the election is over, because El Paso, heavily Hispanic Latino border community, the Rio Grande Valley, that's the same, you know, they're not exactly alike, but even there you see a division. It might have been the COVID fatigue that Luis mentioned. The Rio Grande Valley has been hit very, very hard in the past, but now so is El Paso. So it's almost, you know, we seem to be as confused as anybody else on this at this point. It was a real, you know, disappointing night for Democrats in Texas.
Mm. Jack and Stephen, I'm going to come back to you in just a second here, but I really want to capitalize on the fact that we have both Louis and Luis here with us. So, gentlemen, like, talk to each other. What is it that you'd want to know about the communities in each other's states here? Because as I said at the top of the show, like, I really want to know how we should best understand America now after last night. So what would you want to learn about each other's communities?
You know, Luis, I think it's interesting. We've always thought of Miami especially as what America will probably become, you know, in the decades to come when you talk about the diversity of groups. But, you know, just watching how the two parties came down here to try to win over Latino votes, I think one party understood that each group is different and you've got to find that word or idea to approach each group. You cannot treat a Cuban like a Puerto Rican or a Colombian like a Venezuelan. There's two very different groups of people. But I don't know, did you get the sense when the parties were campaigning in Texas that they understood that?
No, I don't think they did. I think, again, they took it for granted that, you know, that vote was a lock and they, you know, Latinos here in Texas did go overwhelmingly for Biden. But, you know, in a race that every vote counted, you really, you know, even that small percentage was enough for a lot of these places. And but, you know, it is the future of America, this diversity. The Houston Chronicle did just a list of surnames of who voted in early in the county. And you would see, you know, your Johnsons, your Jones, but there was a lot of Garcia, Rodriguez, Martinez, and Nguyen as well. You know, the Vietnamese common surname in Vietnam. So that diversity is there. And it was just the Democrats that just could not capitalize on it in the end.
You had mentioned earlier, too, because I mean, early on the program is that you look at the difference between urban and suburban. But really, here we just look at it as the haves and the have nots. Uh-huh. And I think that in Miami, that is so stark. You know, it's those few people who live in South Beach or, in Brickell, and they have, and then everybody else. And there's so many of us, so many people who don't. And that is a big split that you see that I think played a big role.
Right. So I'm going to just jump back in here for a second because I think that's absolutely right, Louis. And Stephen, let me turn to you here because, you know, there have been a lot of endless hot takes about the quote-unquote emerging Democratic majority. And one of the presumptions in those takes is that it's people of color who would form the core coalition in that emerging Democratic majority. And I think what we're seeing is that that presumption simply does not hold. It cannot hold. It glosses over the diversity within communities, political diversity. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, simple narratives tend to get it wrong, especially when you're talking about people and people's predilections and their behavior. I think this is one of the most interesting and important stories of the 2020 election is this emergence of Latino voters in large numbers across the political spectrum and making a difference in these races. That's something that people have been anticipating for a long time, that they would play this role. And they've been guessing wrong, it turns out, about how monolithic it would be. I think this is not just a good thing for the Latino population. This is a good thing for the Republican Party, which it really risks irrelevance if it continues to have to rely so heavily on white rural voters, white non-college educated rural voters. There is no electoral future in a party that is just that. Appealing the way they did to Latino voters is a step toward the future. Remember what Mitt Romney said when he lost back in 2012, that there was no future for the party if they couldn't do that. I may not like the candidate that was able to do this or the message he did it with, but I think that for the Republican Party in general, this is a step in a more positive direction than they were headed.
Well, Luis, I'm going to give you the last thought here in this segment because, you know, Democrats had been talking about Texas turning purple. is that just wrong now?
That was completely wrong. You know, there's one race left to call, but it's looking like Democrats will go 0-10 in the congressional races that they targeted. There were hopes that they could flip control of the House, which is a big deal because redistricting is coming up next year. And, you know, they're just going to be gerrymandered. It looks like they're going for zero net gains on that. So, no, that's the joke in Texas. You know, Texas is always one cycle away from turning purple. It's getting less funny.
Well, Luis Carrasco, editorial writer and member of the Houston Chronicle's editorial board with us from Houston, Texas. Thank you so much, Luis.
Thank you.
And Luis Hernandez, host of Sundial on WLRN, with us from Miami. Luis, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
All right, Stephen and Jack, hang in here for a moment. We've got to take another quick break. We're going to head to Georgia after that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is the day after end of voting, which was yesterday, and as the nation awaits to learn, it might take a couple of days, might even take longer than that, to know who the next president of the United States will be. We're really digging into also what we need to learn about the nation itself, about Americans who voted in record numbers in 2020. And I'm joined today by Stephen Henderson. He's host of WDET's Detroit Today with us from Detroit, Michigan. Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, is with us, as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Jack, before we head over to Georgia to see the latest of what's happening there, I wanted to just get your reflections on what you heard in the previous segment, and that one of the important areas of understanding that we all need to invest ourselves in is what the Latino communities, I'll put it that way, we're telling America in the vote.
Well, one thing they could be telling America, and this is just simply quoting from some new research, there's evidence that Latino voters, especially men, do not like the term people of color. They don't want to be lumped in with African Americans. And the reason is they figure that this is what the research said, that there's a stigma attached to that, and they don't want that attached to them. That means there's a schism within the Democratic, that sort of resentment, or don't call me a person of color, that is built, you know, that's one of the elements here. Democratic leadership uses that phrase again and again, and yet there's research showing there's resentment, especially among Hispanic Latino men, of that, and because it involves them in the American tragedy of race, they don't want any part of it.
Do you have to hand the reference of where that research is coming from, Jack?
Well, I'm citing a piece by Tom Edsel, who writes about scholarly articles in the New York Times. He quoted extensively in his last column, and maybe the last but one, from a piece of research that brought this out.
Right, and usually he compiles a lot of different studies together in his analyses.
Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay, so Jack and Stephen, hang on here. Let us turn now to Georgia, not settled there in Georgia yet, in either the presidential race, but especially the Senate as well. But regarding the White House, here is former Vice President Joe Biden speaking early this morning from Delaware. He was talking about his chances that he sees in Georgia.
We believe one of the nets has suggested we've already won Arizona, but we're confident about Arizona. That's a turnaround. We also just called it for Minnesota, and we're still in the game in Georgia, although that's not one we expected.
Well, also, early this morning, here is what President Trump had to say about Georgia. He was at the White House.
It's also clear that we have won Georgia. We're up by 2.5% or 117,000 votes with only 7% left. They're never going to catch us. They can't catch us.
That's President Trump in the wee hours this morning from the White House. So let us hear from Atlanta. Rose Scott joins us. She's host of the program Closer Look on WABE, Atlanta's NPR station. Hey there, Rose.
Hi, Meghna. How are you? Did you get any sleep?
I did, actually. I decided to rely on the analysis that we've done for months and just know that there probably wasn't going to be a result last night. So I got a couple of good hours in there. But regarding Georgia, you heard that clip from the president saying it's clear. Is anything clear yet in Georgia?
No. And right now, if you look at the Georgia Secretary of State's website, which was updated about 52 minutes ago, President Trump is at 50.47% and Biden at 48.31%. Now, we need to let you know that Fulton County, which, of course, is one of Georgia's largest, most populous county, they're still counting votes. And Fulton County traditionally has been heavily Democrat. Nobody really knows. It is tight here. And I think this is just an indication of, you know, Georgia's been changing in terms of demographics for a while now. But also that's why you saw a push the last couple of weeks. I mean, President Trump came here four times. You know, that has never happened. Obama was here. Former President Obama was here. Biden came. Harris came. Harris came back a few times. So that lets you know that both parties were well aware that Georgia was going to be a battleground state. But there, and who knows, maybe those last few pushes to come back into the state could help propel one of these to the White House.
I'm seeing here that DeKalb County.
DeKalb.
DeKalb. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Georgia.
They'll get mad if you say
sorry,
it wrong.
Georgia. Oh, sorry, Georgia. Don't hold it against me, okay? I'm here to learn that DeKalb County is not going to start counting absentee ballots until sometime a little later today. So not even start counting those absentee ballots?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, the election officials have I want to be fair. You know, I always say I'm feisty, but I'm fair. I mean, after what happened in June, a lot of the counties that had issues, DeKalb had counties, obviously Fulton County had major issues. Election officials have worked really hard not to repeat some of the issues that they had. So even in Fulton County, where, you know, doing the early voting, they used the Atlanta Hawks State Farm Arena, and where we have Disney on Ice stuff taking place. They use that for early voting to cut down on long lines. We had some historic turnout in terms of voter participation. So listen, you want them to be fast or to get it right? Whatever right is.
I always vote for getting things as right as possible. But so let me just turn our attention for a second to Georgia's absolutely pivotal role in terms of the United States Senate, right? Because we have those two races, the regular and the special. Mm-hmm. So first of all, let's just listen to a little bit from Democratic senatorial candidate, the Reverend Raphael Warnock, who spoke with his supporters in Georgia last night.
Thank you for pushing me one step closer to the Senate, because when I get there, you will go with me. Your concerns will go with me. Your issues will go with me. But I need you to keep it up for about 62 more days. Can we hang in there?
62 more days, because the runoff's going to happen in January, right? Mm-hmm.
And what I can tell you, Meghna, is that traditionally sometimes it is hard to get folks to come out in a runoff. This should be interesting to see how the Democrats, how much more money and effort they're going to have to put into this state to get their base back out. Kelly Loeffler, who really did not necessarily benefit from Doug Collins, some say she could have, but with Doug Collins being in the mix too, Perhaps, you know, it might have propelled her to a victory. Who knows? But it's going to be very interesting. And Kelly Loeffler is having a bit of a identity crisis among, you know, her base as well. I mean, she was appointed by Governor Brian Kemp. I mean, replacing a longtime, very popular senator in Johnny Isaacson. He did not endorse anybody in this race. So it should be very interesting to see which one of these two candidates will be able to mobilize their supporters to get them back out to the polls.
And so over in the regular race between David Perdue and John Ossoff, that one of them has to get over 50% for the regular to also avoid a runoff. Is that right?
Correct. And if you're John Ossoff's camp, you're hoping that you just take enough of the votes away from David Perdue to possibly to push to a runoff. I mean, early on, and I was doing our election coverage here on WABE, it looked like that Perdue was going to maybe run away with it. But again, with 158 counties or 159 counties in Georgia, well, what's that one county they're still waiting on? Fulton County. Mm.
So it right now, there is the possibility that both Senate seats may not get decided until January, which then puts the balance of power in the Senate still possibly up for grabs. So Georgia's really, really central here in terms of the direction politically, or let me put it this way, in terms of governance in Washington that the nation's going to take here. So, Rose, just take a step back with me. I mean, as you've watched this election season unfold in Georgia, what are the lessons that you want the rest of the country to learn, to know about the state?
Well, first of all, pay no attention to polls. Look, you know, I've been covering politics since 2000 when I was a young producer. What I've learned is that, you know, and as my father would say, the only thing that is certain is that it could be uncertain. So, you know, but again, it's one of those states. Look, we know that southern states have a perception. You know, when I moved here and I'm from the Midwest, I had a perception about the South. The South has changed. And I think what you also see is also this wave of young folks, you know, getting out into the polls. And you're also seeing a more diverse mix of young folks and ethnicities running for state races as well. You know, and I think that that's indicative of how this state is changing. Now, once you get outside of the Atlanta, what we call the 13 counties around Atlanta, and Georgia is a rural state. Let's be clear about that. And so the assumption was always if you were a Republican candidate, you know, running, you know, for Congress, you didn't really worry about like Atlanta and the surrounding counties because you had the 140 something other counties. That's all you needed to win. Well, that's shifting. That's changing. That's no longer a given. But the key is that do they still have enough of support in those rural areas to win these two Senate races outright? And it's a toss-up.
Hmm. All right. Well, so Jack and Stephen, come back in here. I want to get out of the way of the three of you. But Stephen, I'll just toss to you here first. What are you hearing about the Georgia story?
So Georgia sounds a lot like what we're seeing in Michigan right now, which is that you've got this concentration of Democratic votes in the largest urban area that couldn't be counted as quickly as others because they were mail-in votes or they were absentees, and that they may be decisive in the outcome of the state. I can't overstate how big, of course, it would be if Georgia, a state that is associated with the American South and its history so strongly, ends up being in the Democratic column this time. That is a huge, huge electoral shift. I think it also reflects this surge of African-American voting that we're seeing across the country. I mean, we're setting a record here in Detroit for this election. There are records being talked about in places like Philadelphia and Milwaukee. If you contrast that, though, to what you heard the folks from Texas and Florida talking mm-hmm. about in terms of the Latino vote and the way that it turned out, I mean, you see this schism that exists in America just being highlighted in a really dramatic way. And going forward, that is the thing that gives me the most trepidation. I think African American voters need to have allies among other people of color. in order to make electoral differences and change. And I think that's going to be much more difficult than we thought it would be. 2020 is teaching us that there's a lot of work to do there.
I promised you I'd get out of the way, guys. Jack, did you want to jump back in here?
Well, I have a question for Rose. Rose, am I correct in thinking that the runoff system in Georgia Senate elections and elections is akin, a sort of descendant of the white primary? In other words, which was itself a reaction against Reconstruction. It was one of the devices of Jim Crow. And this runoff business where, you know, you have to get 50%, is that in that lineage of, you know, reaction to Reconstruction, the white primary, that was struck down, and now we have this system you've got to get 50%. Is that history sort of baked into the electoral laws?
Now, I'm not a history major, and I don't pretend to be one, so I want to be very fair and be honest and say, you know, I really don't know how that came to be. Georgia has some very interesting history in terms of its political party makeup. Now, remember, keep in mind that the current Democratic Party and the current Republican Party are not your grandfather's old Georgian parties. They are different. Remember, now we also went through this phase where we had the Dixiecrats. So it has definitely shifted as in terms of the lineage. I don't really have the answer to that. I just do not know. And I don't want to say it is and then get an email and, you know.
Sure.
Well, so, you know, what's interesting is that we have been trying to understand over the course of the year sort of where this country is headed. And that, by definition, that is one this is one thing that elections, no matter what their results are, give us a window into that, because it is the chance for voters to speak. So Stephen, let me just give you a last swing here. I think what we're seeing is that this country is growing increasingly more diverse, but that presumptions of what that diversity means, we just can't make those presumptions.
Yeah, I think we're headed for conflict and significant conflict about what this country should be, what this country has been, and what a lot of people want this country to be. In my social circle this morning, there's just a lot of sadness about the sheer number of people, white people, who have voted a second time for Donald Trump, despite all of the things that he said and done that disparage African Americans and other black and brown people. I think that is going to resonate and sting for a long time, and it's going to create a real difficulty around the idea of unifying the country around a direction or a message, whoever the president winds up being, and it's going to go beyond this next presidency. This is going to be something that we're going to be, I think, sparring over for a long time.
Yeah. You know, Rose, we've just got a couple of seconds left here. Jack earlier talked about identity being the biggest driver now in American political life. Of course, the identities we're not talking about are just identities as Americans. But your last thought?
It's ideologies and messaging. And if you are a candidate that can sway someone with an ideology that may or may not even be valid, That's kind of where we've been heading in politics. You know, people want diversity on their own terms. And so they're not looking at it in terms of black, white, brown or whatever. It's we're moving toward ideology. And what can you do to improve my quality of life with your messaging, whether it's true or not?
Right. And then how can that lead to actual policies that that improve people's quality of life? Well, Rose Scott, host of Closer Look on WABE in Atlanta, thank you, Rose. And Stephen Henderson, host of WDET's Detroit Today in Detroit, thank you, Stephen. And Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst, thanks as always. This is On Point.